As the old song says, love walked in. She set him on his ass like no long-armed middleweight ever did. He gave up boxing. He almost gave up everything, including breathing normally for that girl. We had a hard time getting him to go to school. What happened? Well, he went to Colgate and she went to Skidmore. They're reasonably close together, aren't they? I mean, as colleges. Scandalously close. That's why the kids picked him. And every weekend they came home and continued being a sexual inspiration to us all. You never saw two kids so in love. So why didn't they get married? They did, but not to each other. Spring of their senior year in college, Sally Ann was visibly pregnant. I do believe my wife noticed it before Alan. Naturally, we thought it was Alan. We thought it was Alan's kid. It wasn't. I guess their relationship had been as pure as the driven snow. Alan was shaken to his foundation. The kid was caused by a man named Bill Cavanaugh, a town boy. Sally Ann said that she'd had too much to drink at a party here in town one night while Alan was at school, and Cavanaugh had driven her home. She said he had taken advantage of her. She insisted it happened only once, but as Mother Goose said, once is enough. At least it was that time, or more likely she wasn't telling the truth. I've always suspected she was a little impatient with my son. You know, Alan always played everything remarkably straight. There comes a time when a girl wants to get laid, and I suspect Alan was keeping the girl he intended to marry as untried as next year's car. So, Sally Ann Cushing married Cavanaugh? Yep. And Alan took up flying those damn fool aircraft. Between the boxing and the flying, there was a hot and heavy romance with Sally Ann Cushing. Frankly, I think my son has always had a bit of a death urge. Although I suppose I shouldn't tell you that, you're being his insurance man. A bit of the daredevil, except when it came to young love. He treated that very carefully. A bit too carefully, I'd say. This explains a lot. Does this explain that small bequest on the insurance policy? Yes, the name is Sally Ann Cushing Cavanaugh. That's good. She's a nice girl. I've always been a bit in love with her myself. Cavanaugh's a skunk, I've always thought. Never have liked him. The boy, young Bill, is about 12 years old now. One or the other frequently comes in the store, Sally Ann or young Bill. I feel toward them almost like a family. Despite the pregnancy, Alan and Sally Ann still thought of getting married. But Cavanaugh had his rights, and he exerted them. Sally Ann was quite a catch for him. He's in the insurance business, like you, only he's no good at it. The Cavanaughs still live in Nonhegan? Well, yes and no. That's what I was going to tell you. I can't be too sure of Sally Ann's address at this point. Why not? Sally Ann and Bill Cavanaugh got divorced a while back. I'm not sure exactly when. There was a separation. I know they were getting divorced, and she must have gotten it because she sold her house and left town, taking the boy with her. When? When did she leave town? Yesterday. Yesterday? Yep. They sold everything. Furniture, washer, dryer, beds, and kitchenware. There was no moving van at all. She and the boy packed suitcases and took a taxi to the airport. It's a bit of a mystery around here. According to my wife, they were very vague about where they were going. The kid said he was going to go live on the West Coast, out somewhere near you, in California. I expect that after almost 13 years of marriage to that bum Cavanaugh, she just wanted to burn her bridges behind her, find a new life somewhere. Anyway, be shut of this town. Cavanaugh gave her a pretty rough time. Mr. Stanwyck, thank you very much. Well, if there's any question about that little bequest to Sally Ann, you be a good fella and see that she gets what Alan wants to give her. Sally Ann's a wonderful person, and she's had a rotten time. One other question. When your son would visit you in Nonhegan, did he ever see Sally Ann? Why, no. He was at the inn on the telephone all the time, as far as I know. She was married. I suppose he could have seen her. He never mentioned it. Again, many thanks, Mr. Stanwyck. You've been a great help. We won't bother you again. Any time, Mr. James. I'm very happy to have the opportunity to help out Alan. Fletch went through the routine with five local hotels before finding the right one. Desk, please. Desk. Has Mrs. Sally Ann Cavanaugh checked in yet? The sixth hotel desk answered, Yes, sir. Mrs. Cavanaugh and her son checked in yesterday. Did you want their room number? No, thanks. We want to surprise her with some flowers. Can you tell me when she intends to check out? She's keeping the room through Thursday night, sir, but she told us she would actually be leaving Thursday evening after supper. Tomorrow night about 9 o'clock. Well, that should give us plenty of time to send her flowers. Thanks very much. Transworld Airlines reservations. On your flight 629 to Buenos Aires tomorrow night, Fletch said, do you have a reservation for a Mrs. Sally Ann Cushing Cavanaugh and son? What's the name, sir? Mrs. Cavanaugh and son William. No, sir, we do not have reservations under that name. Should we make these reservations, sir? No, that's all right. Do you have a reservation under the name of Irwin Fletcher for the same flight? Irwin Fletcher, yes, sir. Flight 629 to Buenos Aires, departure time 11 p.m. Thursday. That reservation has been confirmed. And you do not have a Sally Ann Cushing Cavanaugh registered aboard that flight? No, sir. We do not have either a Cushing or a Cavanaugh listed as passengers aboard Flight 629. Fletch said, thank you very much. Before making the next phone call, Fletch spent a few moments wandering around the apartment. In the kitchen, he drank a glass of milk. In the bathroom, he brushed his teeth. Back in the bedroom, he spent a few minutes looking into the telephone directory. Then he picked up the phone. Command Air Charter Service? Yes, hello, Command Air Charter Service. This is Irwin Fletcher. I'm calling regarding my reservation for tomorrow night. Yes, Mr. Fletcher, we're glad you called. Your cashier's check arrived this morning as we arranged. The flight is prepaid. An executive jet will be standing by tomorrow night from 10:30 p.m. to 12 midnight for your flight to Rio de Janeiro. You don't expect to be arriving later than 12 midnight, do you, sir? No, I don't. At the airport, aren't you right next to Transworld Airlines? Yes, sir. We use the same parking facilities. I see. We haven't known where to call you, Mr. Fletcher, as you left no telephone number when we talked Friday of last week. You didn't indicate whether or not you'd be traveling alone, sir. No, does it matter? No, sir. Our only question is whether or not you wish a steward flying aboard.
Is one usual?
Well, sir, if you're flying alone, the co-pilot usually can take care of such things as drinks and food.
I see.
Will you wish a steward, sir? It makes no difference in cost to you. It just means one of our able stewards will be flying to Rio and back.
Yes, I will want a steward.
Yes, sir, that's fine. We'll have a steward on board.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fletcher, and thank you for calling in. This flight will not need to be confirmed again. After replacing the telephone receiver, Fletch remained sitting on the bed. It was 7:10. There were 25 hours and 20 minutes before he was next scheduled to meet Alan Stanwyck. Fletch went over in his mind precisely what he had to do in that 25 hours and 20 minutes and ordered the doing of these things in a time sequence. After making the plan, he adjusted it and then reviewed it. There was plenty of time for what he had to do. At 7:30, Fletch fell asleep with his alarm set for 1:30 Thursday morning. At 3:30 Thursday morning, Fletch parked his car on Berman Street, the hills, 300 yards from the Stanwyck driveway. In sneakers and jeans and a dark turtleneck sweater, Fletch entered the Stanwyck property by the driveway. Leaving the driveway immediately, he approached the side of the house by walking in an arc across the left lawn. He entered the library of the Stanwyck house by the French window. He reflected that it had even been true that the servants perpetually forgot to lock that door. Using only moonlight, he slid open the top right drawer of the desk. As he suspected, the .38-caliber Smith & Wesson revolver was still in the drawer. And, as he had suspected, the bullet clip had been removed. He returned the empty gun to the drawer. At 5:15 Thursday morning, Fletch was in his office at the News Tribune, writing a story for Thursday afternoon's newspaper. Chapter 29. For First Thursday, P.M., Body Found, with Cuts, R. Sanders Fletcher. The nude body of a 15-year-old girl was discovered buried in the sand off Shoreside Boulevard, the beach, by police this morning. The body was found encased in a sleeping bag in a shallow grave in the shade of the seawall as the result of a tip from an anonymous caller. The body has been identified as that of Roberta Bobby Sanders, believed to be originally from Illinois. It is expected that in his report, Coroner Alfred Wilson will estimate the time of death sometime late Sunday night or early Monday morning, and the cause of death as an overdose of drugs.
According to a police spokesman, the sleeping bag is a popular brand and there is little expectation it can be traced to its owner. The girl, abandoned at the beach by a 30-year-old male traveling companion some months ago, had no known local address. Her friends are not known to police. She had no known means of support. The anonymous caller this morning was described by police as probably male. It is reported by the receiving officer that an obvious attempt was made by the caller to muffle or disguise the voice. The beach police are making every effort to locate the girl's family in Illinois. It is believed her father is a dentist. For First Thursday PM, FP, police chief implicated Fletcher with exhibits. 1, Montgomery affidavit. 2, Witherspoon affidavit. 3, Cummings's handwritten note, enclosed, captioned with cuts. Cummings, Witherspoon, Montgomery, you have in rack. The News Tribune delivered to the district attorney's office this morning evidence implicating Chief of Police Graham Cummings in illegal drug trafficking in the beach area. The evidence includes an affidavit signed by Charles Witherspoon, alias Vatsyayana, alias Fat Sam, who identifies himself in the affidavit as the disseminator of illegal drugs in the beach area. An affidavit signed by Lewis Montgomery, who identifies himself in the affidavit as the drug runner to Fat Sam. And a handwritten note to Sam regarding drug running problems, signed Cummings. These affidavits identify Chief Cummings as the source of illegal drugs in the beach area. The affidavits are dated with yesterday's date. This morning, the beach police discovered the body of a 15-year-old girl, Roberta Bobby Sanders, buried in a shallow grave near the main seawall at the beach, dead of a drug overdose. See related story. The evidence implicating Cummings is the result of a special investigation by the News Tribune beginning a month ago. Both Witherspoon and Montgomery were placed in protective custody before noon today. The arrest of Chief Cummings by federal narcotics agents is expected later today. According to the affidavits, Cummings, 59, under the guise of establishing a home in Mexico preparatory to his retirement a year hence, has been smuggling drugs in from Mexico on a monthly basis for more than 4 years. Street prices for these drugs have totaled as much as $75,000 a month. Cummings' personal car, which he used on his frequent trips to Mexico, is a late-model dark blue Chevrolet sedan, with plates front and back reading Chief of Police. The car is equipped with a police radio. A rotating flashing light similar to those used on official police cars is on the roof of Cummings's privately owned car. A high-powered Winchester rifle is slung beneath the dashboard. It is unknown whether Cummings also wore his police uniform while going through customs. It is known that his wife and teenage daughter frequently have made the trip with him. Cummings has been a member of the Beach Police Force 19 years. Prior to his police career, he was a career non-commissioned officer in the U.S. Army. Montgomery is the son of James Montgomery, superintendent of schools at the beach. According to the affidavits, town police regularly would pick up young Montgomery for questioning. Once alone in the office of the chief of police, the transfer of drugs for cash would take place between Montgomery and Cummings. Montgomery states the belief these transactions were completely unknown to other police officers. Montgomery would transfer both drugs and money in a money belt concealed beneath a loose Hawaiian shirt. Pretending to make a purchase of drugs from Witherspoon, Montgomery would in fact drop the drug-laden money belt in a place prearranged for Witherspoon to find it. Although the widespread presence of illegal drugs in the beach area was visible, the method of how the drugs came to be in the area was invisible. An earlier drug runner, a 19-year-old simply identified in the affidavit as Jeff, reportedly committed suicide 4 years ago. The handwritten note allegedly from Cummings was written at the time of Jeff's suicide. It refers to the problem of replacing Jeff as a drug runner by Montgomery. According to his own affidavit, Montgomery has been running drugs since the age of 14. Originally, when it was time for another transfer, Montgomery would signal Cummings by leaving his bicycle chained to a parking meter visible through the window of the office of the chief of police. The bicycle had a distinct purple banana seat and a high rearview mirror. Later, the signal that Montgomery wanted to be picked up for questioning so a transfer of money for drugs could take place would be his parking a flower-decorated Volkswagen minibus within sight of the police chief's office window. The vehicle is registered to Witherspoon. Witherspoon, 38, has been living apparently undisturbed by police in a lean-to on the beach for years. He identifies himself as a former music teacher with the Denver, Colorado public school system. In his affidavit, Witherspoon states that he and only he has been selling the drugs supplied by Cummings in the beach area. Both Witherspoon and Montgomery state they had no share in the profits from the illegal drug trade. Self-attested addicts, they profited only by having their own drug needs supplied free of charge by Cummings. They both attest that they were forced to continue in this traffic by Chief Cummings, who threatened them with evidence in his possession that they had been involved in drug dealing. Witherspoon had sold drugs illegally in the beach area before becoming an agent of the police chief. Witherspoon stated, "I was as much a prisoner of the chief of police, both by my need for drugs and by evidence he had on me, as I would have been if I were sitting in the town jail." As chief of police, Cummings had refused offers of assistance from private sources to have the town's drug problems investigated by outside experts. Such a repeated offer by John Collins, chairman of the board of Collins Aviation, was repeatedly refused. According to Collins, Cummings always insisted he was within a few months of breaking the case. He made a similar insistence to the News Tribune Tuesday of this week. After handing in the originals and duplicates of both stories to the copy desk of the afternoon newspaper, Fletch spent time identifying the photographs he had ordered processed 2 days before and drafting captions for them. The photographs were of Roberta Sanders, Police Chief Graham Cummings, which had been in the News Tribune picture files, Charles Witherspoon outside the lean-to handing a small cellophane-wrapped package of heroin to Creasy, who was not identifiable in the photograph, and of Louis Montgomery, dressed in a Hawaiian shirt, standing beside the Volkswagen minibus. He Xeroxed two copies each of the affidavits and Cummings's handwritten note and turned both copies over to the copy desk. One clear copy of each would be photographed, engraved, and printed in the News Tribune with his second story. The originals of the affidavits and the handwritten note he brought back to his office and placed in an addressed envelope. He telephoned for a city messenger. Then he sealed the envelope. It was only then that Fletch made the telephone contacts he had already reported in news stories already being printed. "Beach Police, please state your name and the number from which you're calling." With his handkerchief between his mouth and the telephone receiver, Fletch said, "I want to report a body." "Please state your name and the number from which you are calling." "There's a body buried on the beach of a girl, the girl Bobby. She is buried in a sleeping bag. She's dead."
"Who is this?"
"This is not a hoax. Bobby is buried on the beach near the seawall, the only place along the seawall where the sand is perpetually in the shade, where it curves and the sidewalk overhangs, up the beach from Fat Sam's lean-to. There is a rock from the seawall placed over the exact spot where she is buried. Have you got that? Please repeat. The body of Bobby is buried on the beach next to the seawall not far from Fat Sam's lean-to. There is a rock placed precisely on the sand where she is buried."
"Please identify yourself. Who is this calling?"
Fletch said, "Please find Bobby." At 7:45 Thursday morning, the city messenger appeared in Fletch's office. He was about 25 years old, wearing a black leather jacket and carrying a motorcycle helmet. Without saying anything, Fletch handed him the envelope containing the original affidavits and the original of Cummings's handwritten note. The messenger read the address and, without saying anything, left. At 7:50, Fletch dialed a suburban number. "Hello? Good morning, Audrey. You sound as fresh as a morning glory."
"Fletcher, is that you?
Sharp as a tack, too.
Why are you calling at this hour? I'm trying to get the kids off to school."
"I just want to make sure you're awake and have the coffee on for Alston."
"He's had his coffee. He's just leaving for the office."
"Call him back, will you, Audrey? I need to speak to him."
"He's right here, trying to kiss me goodbye."
"How could he ever?"
"Fletcher, you're sweet. Here's Alston."
"Is this Alston Chambers, our distinguished district attorney?"
"Hiya, buddy. I'm not district attorney. I'm what is known as the district attorney's office. That means I just do all the work."
"I know. Audrey sounds pretty fresh for 8 o'clock in the morning."
"She makes up for the coffee with morning sprightliness. I can't stand either. That's why I leave for the office so early. What's up, buddy?"
"Alston, I'm sending over to your office by messenger a couple of depositions or affidavits or whatever you legal types call them, and a signed handwritten note. They should be in your office by the time you get there."
"Okay, what do they say?"
"They should be self-explanatory. Briefly, what they say is that Graham Cummings, the chief of police at the beach, is and has been, for at least 4 years, the source of illegal drugs in the beach area.
Wow! Graham Cummings? He's as clean as a hound dog's tooth.
We thought he was as clean as a hound dog's tooth.
I'm sorry to hear this.
Actually, so am I.
Has anybody arrested him yet?
No, that's a bit of a problem, as you can see. You'll have to arrange that.
Right, Irwin. It will take time.
Time?
A few hours. First, I have to get your depositions and copy them. Then I'll have to get in touch with federal narcotics agents, show them the depositions, and so forth. Then they'll have to send someone down there after having gotten an arrest warrant.
Don't be too long about it if you miss him. He'll probably head for the Mexican border in his own car, which looks like a police car, bubble machine and all. He has a police radio in the car and a high-powered rifle. Apparently, he's used it to fool customs a lot. Anyway, it's a dark blue Chevrolet sedan, license number 706552.
Give me the number again.
706552.
Okay, you sure you're right about this?
Yep.
Boy, Graham Cummings, I can't believe it.
Look, Alston, even before you pick up Cummings, there's something else I want you to do for me.
You've already given me a morning's work.
I know, but I want the two people who signed these affidavits to be picked up and put in protective custody.
Right, where are they?
At 11 o'clock this morning, they'll be waiting to be picked up at the beer stand at the main section of the beach. You know, the beer stand that you can see from Shoreside Boulevard.
I know the place.
They'll be there waiting.
What are their names?
Witherspoon and Montgomery. A couple of terrible-looking fellas. Witherspoon's 38, Montgomery 17. Their names will be on the depositions.
Of course.
And, Alston, be quick about this, will you? I've already got the story splashed all over the afternoon paper, and you know that comes off the presses at 11:22.
Ah, yes, Fletcher, the terrific journalist.
And there's a death involved here.
Murder?
No. A 15-year-old girl found overdosed this morning at the beach. Cummings could turn into a dangerous man very easily.
Fletcher, did I ever tell you you're a great journalist?
No.
Irwin Fletcher, you are. You really are. I hope the News Tribune appreciates you.
They're about to fire me.
Nonsense.
Something about my not wearing shoes in the office.
Hey, old buddy Irwin. I get to see you honored tomorrow.
What do you mean?
Thanks for inviting me to witness your receiving the Bronze Star.
I didn't invite you.
I got an invitation from the promotion department of the News Tribune.
I didn't send it.
You must have made up the invitation list.
I made up no invitation list.
I'm coming anyway. All us old comrades in arms are very proud of you, you know. All I ever won in the Marines was a disease coffee doesn't cure.
Do you still have it?
No, I lost it on a toilet seat.
At City Hall, I hope.
Probably. I thought you picked up the Bronze Star years ago.
I never picked it up.
Will you pick it up tomorrow?
Sure, Fletch said. Sure.
I'll be there.
You be there. Better look pretty. There'll be photographers.
I'll wear a smile. See you then, Fletcher.
See you then.
Fletcher!
It was 9:30 in the morning, and Fletch was going home for the day. He had waited to see the front page proof at 9:15. It was beautiful. Both stories began above the fold with pictures of Bobby and Cummings. The jumps, with more pictures, would be on page 3, with full reproductions of the affidavits and handwritten note and more pictures. A blockbuster. Copy editors had changed very little of his copy. A veritable 1-2 hell of a blockbuster. He had the key in the ignition of the MG.
Oh, hello, Clara.
She had parked her Gray Vega station wagon down the line of cars waiting to take their owners home again.
How are you, sweetheart?
Fletcher, this is Thursday.
I know. She was leaning over his car door like a traffic officer.
Where are you going?
Home.
I haven't seen the beach drug story yet.
I know.
I told you, you're to have that story in by 4 o'clock this afternoon.
When would you run it?
I don't know. I'll have to do some work on it first.
Would you run it tomorrow?
I don't know. It depends on how much work we have to do on it.
Would you run it in the Sunday paper?
I don't know. Frank said something about holding it for a week or two. He said you had some crazy idea Graham Cummings is implicated.
Did I say that?
They're friends.
Oh.
Is Cummings implicated? His name is mentioned in the story. It's up to Frank and me when the story runs in the paper. It's your job to get the story on my desk by 4 o'clock this afternoon.
Have I ever disappointed you yet, Clara?
I'm serious, Fletcher.
Have no fear. You'll see the story this afternoon.
You're sure?
Clara, I'm absolutely sure. This afternoon, you'll see the Drug Beach story.
I'd better.
You will.
And you'd better plan on being in the Marine Commandant's office at 10 o'clock tomorrow morning.
Don't worry about that, either.
Okay, your job is on the line.
I'd hate to lose it, Fletch said. You know how I love working with you.
Fletch turned the ignition key. Fletch, I'll see you by 4 o'clock at the latest.
You'll see the story by 4 o'clock, Fletch said.
Maybe even a little earlier.
Chapter 30. Fletch spent most of Thursday alone in his apartment. He ate. He slept. He destroyed the Stanwyck tape. He typed a letter to John Collins. He typed an original and a single carbon copy of the letter, and threw the original of the letter away. The copy he placed folded in the inside pocket of his suit jacket. He emptied the wastebaskets. At 11:30, the phone began ringing persistently. He knew it was Clara Snow and or Frank Jaffe, or any one of several other News Tribune executives who characteristically became excited, one way or the other, in pleasure if they were real professionals, in anger if they were not, when a staff member had snuck a genuine, unadulterated piece of journalism over on them. In all newspapers Fletch had seen, there was always a hard core of genuinely professional working staff which made it possible to commit genuine journalism occasionally, regardless of the incompetence among the executive staff. The afternoon newspaper was on the streets. The excited callers apparently went out to lunch at 1 o'clock. The phone did not begin ringing relentlessly again until 2:30. At 3 o'clock, the lobby doorbell rang. Fletch pressed the buzzer to unlock the downstairs lobby door and waited. In a moment, his own apartment doorbell rang. He opened the door to Joan Collins Stanwyck.
Good afternoon, Mr. Fletcher.
Good afternoon, Mrs. Stanwyck.
Fletcher, as I said, is a name I can remember.
You know who I am?
Thank you, I do.
Won't you come in? She entered and sat on the divan. May I offer you a drink?
No, thank you, Mr. Fletcher, but you may offer me an explanation.
Ah? Fletch remained standing, taking a step this way, a step that. In the 11th hour, his cover had been blown.
Mr. Fletcher, why are you investigating my husband? Or is it I you are investigating?
Neither of you, Fletch said. Also, he found this Mr. and Mrs. business a bit cumbersome between two people who had made love, both Polish and Romanian style, only 2 days before.
What makes you think I'm investigating you?
Mr. Fletcher, I have been born, bred, and educated to do a job, as I gather you have, because clearly you are very good at your job. My job is to support and protect my father and my husband, and I'm rather good at it. In fact, protect Collins Aviation, and its investors, and the people it employs, etc.
I see. One can't have this subtle job for as many years as I've had it without developing certain subtle instincts. At a lunch at the Racquets Club Saturday when you and I first met, after a while my intuition told me I was being questioned. For the life of me, I could not figure out what I was being questioned about, so I took your picture.
Without looking at it, she transferred it from her purse to the coffee table. It was a 3/4 Polaroid shot of Fletch in a tennis shirt in the Racquets Club pavilion.
While you were getting another chair for the table after my father joined us, I turned your picture over to the Collins Plant Security Monday morning. It was just this morning I received their report. You are I.M. Fletcher of the News Tribune. Your identity was confirmed by a city police detective named Lupo and has since been confirmed again by the newspaper itself.
Fletch said, Wow.